The Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast is proud to be sponsored by Dr. Spork's 3D Terrain. From retro greenskin outposts to elven fortresses and obelisks, this is hands down the best nostalgic scenery you'll find out there, and all at stupidly reasonable prices. Check it out for yourself by heading over to bedroombattlefields.com/spork, that's S-P-O-R-K, and turn your tabletop into a scene from White Dwarf circa 1994. Andy Chambers not included. Brought to you by bedroombattlefields.com, this is the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. It's Matthew with you here. And on this episode, this is a little joint effort between myself and Dan over at Paint All the Minis. So Dan's always run these episodes called Why I Love, and I've always really enjoyed these as well on his show, where basically somebody comes on and just gets really into the weeds on a certain game that they really like. And I've actually discovered a few games through these episodes, most notably Open Combat when I got back into the hobby, or shortly after I got back into the hobby. It was one of those episodes on Dan's show where one of his guests got really into Open Combat, and you know, it's a game that I've played ever since. So really great episodes, and I noticed recently on his show Dan's wee bottom lip was trembling because he didn't have any episodes in the can. So I reached out to him. I said, look, I know this will be scraping the barrel, but what about if I come on and talk about Hobgoblin, which I've been playing quite a lot recently and thoroughly enjoying. So yeah, he had a good think about that. Couldn't find anyone else to get on the show, so we made it happen. So yeah, this is a conversation that will go out on both feeds, and it's basically about why I love Hobgoblin.
So you heard us talk about a specific game, Hobgoblin, but before we get into that, talk about your other games, just to remind people who are listening along, what other games have you played fairly recently that you also enjoy?
Yeah, so I have been playing a fair bit of Blood Bowl recently. So it's the 2020 edition, which I think Games Workshop have just updated with a new version. Not that I'm bothered about that. I don't think they've changed very much anyway. But yeah, Blood Bowl, been enjoying that. I am a fan of Rangers of Shadowdeep as well. I really like that for a kind of narrative solo or co-op sort of skirmish. Frostgrave, I like Frostgrave, and Song of Blades and Heroes as well as a skirmish game I'm partial to. So yeah, I've got a little stable of games that kind of tick every kind of genre and table size. So Hobgoblin's very much my mass fantasy rank and flank game. So
nice. Before we get deep into that, the last time we spoke you just were complaining a lot about putting together your halfling Blood Bowl team, right? So how did that go, and how was your experience of playing Blood Bowl been?
Oh, the gnomes, yeah, the gnome team.
Oh, the gnomes, yeah, sorry, yeah.
They were a proper nightmare to put together. You know, somebody who's very used to getting lumps of metal, you know, the miniature is just made for you, and you just clean it up and glue it to a base. So going to this, like, just opening what seemed like endless amounts of sprues, and it was like, put this shoulder onto this arm, onto this elbow, onto this hand, and put the fingers on, and it was just like, I got the gnomes because I thought, well, there'll be wee guys, there won't be that much to stick together, but how wrong I was. So I got the gnome team, but I actually ended up, like, I had some Chaos Beastmen from the Chaos team, the Chaos All-Stars in the 90s. I had some of them left over because I had Blood Bowl when I was in my teens. So I ended up, like, getting the Chaos Warrior players. So I made a Chaos team, or rebuilt a Chaos team.
Oh, nice.
I've got the Human team from that era as well, which I just recently painted up. So now I've got three teams, so it gives me a bit of variety. When the wife's given me a good tanking, and she beats me at Blood Bowl as well.
What's been your favourite experience of doing it? Like, what's been your favourite part of playing Blood Bowl?
I think because it's very much a boxed game, it's been, like, she has humoured me in the past playing various miniature games, but we talk about this a lot on both our podcasts, how for some folks who aren't in the hobby, just that, like, I don't know if it's the mental thing of like the box contains everything and there's no like ambiguity about, you know, where you are and what you're doing. It's just like it's a boxed game. Ostensibly a board game, which, you know, people are generally familiar with board games, aren't they? Whereas they're not so familiar with a do-what-you-want miniature game. So I think that's helped her get on board. And she tells me anyway, whether she's been honest or not, but she tells me she's enjoying it. And it's just, it's good to be able to play a game like that, which, you know, scratches that miniature game itch, but it's also a board game. So,
yeah. Yeah, those standalone experiences are always really good. It's a little bit less overbearing. I think you don't have to get your tape measure out. I think that kind of helps as well. It's just like, you know, there's a lot of similarities between, you know, that and many other traditional board games. Move around, you can move so many squares. It kind of breaks down a lot of the barriers of bigger things, you know, which is cool. That's good, man. It's good that you've been playing it together. That's awesome. That's really cool. Mass fantasy is definitely seems to be your thing. And mass battle is something that you talk about quite a lot. So would you say that fantasy mass battle is like your wheelhouse? Is that your favourite experience, would you say?
I think, yeah, when you look at my origins in the hobby when I was picking up White Dwarf magazines in like 93, 94, and it was the big aspirational goal for me was what I was seeing in White Dwarf was big games of Warhammer Fantasy, big units, the battle reports. I was really partial to those. So there was always part of me wanted to have that on the tabletop. And I think, you know, getting a game like Hobgoblin is just, it's a great fit. I built up a couple of armies and I feel like now I'm kind of, although it's a different game, it's a different rule set, I feel like I'm getting those White Dwarf battle report experiences, that kind of big Warhammer-y, for lack of a better term, battle on the table.
Yeah, that's cool. So let's start getting onto it. How did you choose that one? What was it about that game that made you more interested than other fantasy games in that genre?
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously, like, we're spoiled for choice when it comes to playing this style of game. You could literally, you know, use one of the old much-loved Warhammer editions, which many people do. You've got Kings of War, which I've played a good few times, and I really like it. There's also a game from Brent Spivey, Mayhem, it's called, which is a really good game too. But, Hobgoblin, I was listening a lot to Mike Hutchinson and his co-host Glenn Ford's podcast, so I was kind of bought into this just because I was listening through all these episodes about them developing the game, and now and then they would do a little catch up on how it was going. So I think that's what won me over to it. It was just hearing the development process and, you know, getting kind of behind it when it was coming out, and that it just made me really interested to check it out. And, you know, you're not buying a massive box here. You're literally just buying a book. So it was a low commitment, a low investment. And then once I read the rules, I was like, yeah, I really want to try this, and played it a couple of times and thoroughly enjoyed it. So it was as simple as that. It wasn't like I'm saying, not buying what a modern Games Workshop box game might be, where it's just a massive investment. You've got all the miniatures and everything like that. This was just a case of buying a book, trying it out, and realizing that I really enjoyed it and wanted to keep playing it.
That's cool. So give us a synopsis then. So what is Hobgoblin?
Yeah, so it is a mass fantasy rank and flank game. So if you think about maybe 6 to 10 or 12 units on the table, those could be anything you like. And, you know, you could imagine your old school Warhammer armies, or, you know, Mantic miniatures, or just miniature agnostic forces put together. You could play it at any scale as well. So, you know, 20 is the obvious one, but I play it at 15. So just everything's a bit more scaled down. But I think at that scale, miniatures still retain their individuality, if you like, but you could do it at 6 or whatever. It's not really, doesn't really matter what scale you're playing it at. And it's a game that you can play pretty quickly. Like, you could get a game done in about an hour to an hour and a half, typically. And I like the way that it just gets straight into the action. So you're only deploying about 16 inches apart, So really the first turn, where in other games the first turn is just a bit of foreplay with Hobgoblin, you're just right into it. And I've heard it compared as, you know, when you're watching a film or a TV show where it's the cold open and it just opens in the action, rather than, you know, like I'm saying, guys waking up in their tent in the morning, soldiers scratching their arse and that, waiting to get down to the front line. So, yeah, it just feels on that first turn like you're suddenly like, wow, we're right in, you know, things are happening. So I kind of like that about it too.
That's cool. So you mentioned you followed along with the development. You got interested in that. You mentioned a couple of like what could be called USPs, right? You mentioned that you're straight into the action. You mentioned the short game time, really, comparatively speaking, in other kind of fantasy games, like about 90 minutes, right? So how much kind of lore and story is included in the rule book? Is it just something like Mayhem, which is very kind of slimmed down, and it's literally just some rules and it's very generic? Or is it very deep?
Yeah, like Mike has provided a full story world, and there's a lot of lore in the book. It's very well put together. To be honest, that isn't something that personally interests me. Like, I know some folks get really into that sort of thing. For me, like, I've no problem coming up with my own story worlds or settings or backgrounds. Like, I quite enjoy that aspect of it. But for somebody who wants to play in like Mike's universe, you know, that's all there for you. But it's certainly when it comes down to an army level or a unit level, it's very much left up to you to build your army. And again, that is one of the big benefits of it, is that you could have this really cool unit in your collection and it's totally up to you how you stack them up. So if you love this unit of troops that you painted up, you're not getting handed the stats for them and it turns out they're actually not very good and they're just always going to die. Like, you could make them a totally elite unit. You could make them like the jewel in your crown, if you like. So creatively there's a lot of freedom when you're building your army, but yeah, the lore, you could either take that fully on board or just disregard it, really.
Nice. And you get into this point I was going to ask next about, like, how, like, what factions or kingdoms exist. Is it a little bit like Oathmark, where you can include lots of different people from lots of different races, or is it very specific, you know, how you're building an army? And then also you mentioned about statting things in different ways, so talk to us about that.
Yeah, so there's absolutely no limit on who you could have in your army. Like, if you want to have, you know, a block of human troops and then some orcs and then some skeleton, you could do that if you want. Because really it's all down to assigning a unit type to every unit. So for example, you've got like light infantry, ranged infantry, light cavalry, heavy cavalry, you've got monsters. You basically just have to assign a unit type to every unit in your army, and then that gives you a baseline of stats, and then you'll add keywords to them. So most of the keywords are positive things. They're going to cost points to add on, so you'll have like an elite keyword where you I think that's when you reroll misses once. So you've got a lot of good positive keywords you could add, but also to bring your cost down as well, you could add some negative keywords. So for example, there's one called Berserker, which means that your unit constantly has to advance before they get into combat, so you can't hold them back in reverse. They just want to go for it, and if you don't constantly move them forward, they're going to start picking up, which we'll get to later, they're going to start picking up doom tokens. So yeah, you're building your army, and you could make it very thematic to the miniatures that you're using, just based on A, the troop type, and B, the keywords that you're going to add to them.
That's cool. It's good that you can be so flexible. There's certain games really like to pigeonhole us into certain unit sizes or unit factions or the look, or even sometimes even you have to buy them from this specific retailer or this specific company. So it's really good that it can be so flexible, because you could use forces that you've already got, or like I said, like you said there, you could have some skeletons next to humans. It really kind of leaves the door open for you to do whatever you want, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's complete freedom. And I know, you know, that divides opinion, because for me, that is perfect. But I know there's other people out there, and there's no right or wrong way. Some people just like to know, this is your army, this is their stats. You know, here's their book. on you go. And I know some people love that, and that's fine. But for me, being able to look at my collection and create the ideal army around that, I just really enjoy that aspect of it away from the tabletop.
It tends to be like rock, paper, scissors in a sense of, you know, heavy cavalry beats this and kind of, you know, spear infantry beats that and swordsmen beat that. Have you kind of found those rhythms of the game yet, or have you not played enough games to really find that?
No, 100%. And that's a good way to look at it, is the rock, paper, scissors thing. Because, yeah, everything has its Achilles heel. Some things are very strong against others, like heavy cavalry, for example, is a very, very potent unit. But if you could get a monster up against that, it'll smash them. So there's all these little matchups. And when you play it a few times, you begin to notice, like, okay, I've got these guys here. I really need to get these in front of these other guys. Whereas you've got some units where I need to keep them away from them because they'll mash them. So, there's always a solution there. It's just a matter of finding it.
Yeah, and we'll not talk about this now, we'll get onto it, but deployment is always very important with fantasy games. In fantasy mass battle games, it's the same. In games that I've played, you know, making sure you think about those matchups when you deploy and how you deploy in the game is something that's what sets different fantasy games out from others. But before we get onto that, talk to us about, like, is there a general kind of points value game or certain size game that you play? And you said about like 12 units maximum, but is that taking a lot of chaff? Like, how is an army generally constructed? And do you have a lot of options, or is it kind of limited?
Yeah, so the games that myself and former guest of your fine show, Callum, aka Dr. Sport, we've played a few games of this now. So we've been playing around 4,000 points. I don't really know. I don't have enough experience to know how that compares to other games in the same genre, but that was typically 9-10 units total.
Okay.
And yeah, like I'm saying, the points are, you've got your points for each troop type initially, and then your keywords could bump that up depending on how many positive keywords, or bring it down again if you're adding some negatives as well. So you could kind of fine tune and get a pretty fair match up there. But we found, not that Callum and I are very narrative first, we're not obsessed with points and fairness and balance, but we have found the games to be very balanced, which has just been a positive because we've had no idea who's going to win until basically the last turn. So that's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's good. And how you're obviously looking at different army constructions, right? So some games have, like, you have to take two troops, and then you have to take or you can take one elite for each two troops. So is there any, like, stipulations on you can only take so many of that, or is it complete free reign where you can construct it however you want to, as long as you don't go above the agreed points limit?
Yeah, I mean, as far as I know, you could do what you want. You could just have like 20 cannons or that if it was like, you know, if you'd agreed a points limit with your opponent. And there's, by the way, there's absolutely no need to have fair points by any means. But yeah, if you both wanted to agree a certain amount of points, I think you could just do what you want. Yeah, 10 monsters, you know, almost all archers or whatever. It's, total freedom for you.
That's cool. I like games like that are completely free. I know that, like, you know, we used to play War Master. It was like, you know, you play like, say, 2,000 points, and then it's like you got certain units that you can only take after you've taken other things. And I guess that adds to balance, but also the flip side, just doing stuff that you want to do is pretty cool, right? So once you constructed your force, this is what I kind of really want to get onto, like, how you've got your force, you're at the table. Like, do you roll up a scenario? Is there scenarios?
Yeah, so there's scenarios in the book. We've not got to those yet, although the next game we definitely want to try one of those. So we've played a couple of different, like, setups. Like, I do actually, I said a couple of armies. I've built three armies. So I've got a human army, an orc and goblin army, and a chaos army. So I've got, like, two bad, one good. So the second last game that we played, Callum basically took charge of the bad guys in their entirety, which was a huge army. And I was trying to hold out with the human forces. And we did a couple of things with the keywords and that to make it a bit fairer, just to make the battle last a wee bit longer. So that was a scenario in itself. The last game was pretty much a pitched battle, and we've got a couple of ideas for what we try next. But we try and keep it very narrative. But yeah, if you're playing it by the book, there is a opportunity to either roll up a scenario or you get a little card deck where you could draw one as well. So plenty of options there if you just want a scenario put in front of you.
That's cool. Again, so it seems to be like a game that leans into like you taking control and you having the ideas. Would you say that's right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think predominantly this is a game for the narrative player, although it is, like I say, it's very well balanced. I think without having any competition experience, I think it would hold up well in a tournament because, like I say, it seems very balanced and robust, and there's not a lot of ambiguity anywhere. But for me as a narrative gamer, I just really enjoy the way it plays.
Yeah. And getting on to what we talked about before about deployment always seems to be quite an important thing in fantasy games, especially rank and flank, where you got blocks of units and setting up the matchups. And there's different games do it in different ways. I'd probably say my favorite experience is kind of like a semi fantasy mass battle game called Battle Lore, which is kind of, it is board based, it's hex based. But in that game, you've got like your units on these little cards. And you've got your units, but you've also got a bunch of decoys. And so basically you've got like a deployment area for the scenario, and you've got all of the hexes where you could potentially deploy units. And what you do is you put all the cards face down, covering all of the deployment points. But some of those cards could be decoys and some of those cards could be actual units. So when you're looking at your mate, all you can see is a bunch of face down cards. And then once you've both put all those cards down, you kind of turn those cards over, and then that's your deployment. And I really like that, because there's lots of different ways to do deployment. Some do alternate deployment. So I'll deploy a unit, you deploy a unit, I'll deploy a unit, you deploy a unit. So there's lots of different ways. I'm interested to hear about how deployment happens in this game. So you're at the table, you've got your army, you've got your scenario. Like, how do you then get those armies onto the table to then start a game?
Yeah, this is where I'm going to do the game a disservice and say we've just been deploying, we've been doing the alternate. So there might be something very clever here in the book that I'm going to do a disservice by not mentioning, because yeah, we're just deploying like the last time. I think we rolled for who would put one down first, and you know, I put one down, like you're saying, then he put one down, and we just kept going back and forward until we were deployed, basically. But yeah, like I say, there could potentially be something much more clever in the book, and I'm here championing the game and I don't even know it. So
right, so you're just doing, so you're kind of semi using a book, right? Or like you're just kind of like, hey, we're just going to do our own thing, we're just using a book as a guide, but really we're enjoying just doing our own individual thing, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, I think aside from that, I don't know that we're going away from the book very much, just on the deployment, I guess. I guess I've just not looked in too much as to what the official guidelines are, but I'm sure Mike won't be precious
about it. That's cool, man. I mean, no, that's good. I like that. That's cool. Because it's refreshing, like when you get very constrained by certain games at certain times, it's refreshing to just be like, yeah, I'm just doing what I think seems right. It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
So you do an alternate point, because that's always really important. So like, you know, there's a certain game that I play a lot, and I find that, you know, getting those matchups down early. But even now, I've played like a lot of that game. It's a little bit like Macbeth, right? You can't mention a name, it brings bad luck. But I played a lot of that game, and even starting to try and bait certain matchups. So like, I know his strong units, he knows my strong units, and so I'll purposely try and bait certain matchups, or make it seem like I want to match up with one unit, but then actually turn it around. So it's pretty tactical when you come to deployment. So, but you mentioned that you're quite close when you deploy, right? And so that's probably something that sets the game aside from other fantasy games, because a lot of fantasy games, they, you know, the first turn is generally just marching straight down the table. Right. So you're mentioning that you're kind of getting straight into the action. So is it generally the same as other fantasy games in terms of like your actions of your units? So you're like looking at a move, which is like pivot, move, pivot, a march, which is double distance and then pivot. Like, what are your options for a unit when it's your turn to activate?
Yeah. So I guess there's a few things to say about the turn sequence, because I don't know if it's common with most other games in this ilk, but you'll generally like move everyone first, whereas before you get to the movement phase, like the game's broken into different phases. So you've got like initiative, then you've got magic, then you've got shooting, then you've got movement.
Okay.
So you would, I mean, I would have thought this too, like the first thing you're going to do is start moving troops, but there's actually a few things that you're going to do before then. But like you're saying as well, with them starting close together, there's an invisible halfway line down the middle of the field, and then 8 inches back from that, you could deploy in that area. So you've got an 8-inch gap to the halfway line, and then an 8-inch gap for me. So it's 16 inches in total gap between us. And when you look at the movement, you know, of your troops, you could pretty much close that gap straight away once you start moving. So like I say, it gets that contact made a lot earlier. But before the movement happens, you do decide on your initiative, which could pass back and forward during the game. So you don't always know who's going next, which I really like, because it makes it less predictable.
Is it alternate activation, like I do this unit, you do that unit, or do you do everything with your own guys before you move on?
Yeah, so for example, in the shooting phase, you would fire any ranged units that you had, and then I would fire any ranged units that I had. Then in the movement phase, you would move all your guys, then I would move all of mine, and then in combat, you know, you would deal with your combats, then I would reply with mine. So you're doing everything, but within the turn, you know, you're going back and forward, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so instead of like me shooting, then moving, then attacking, it's like you're finishing off that phase before you move on to another one. So it's like you both have an activation within the phase before you move on, right?
Yeah. So there's the phases are almost like mini turns in their own, and then once you've done each phase, you've actually ended the turn and you're starting again. And an initiative could pass on to the other player. Like I might have initiative, but there's a chance that, you know, when we go into the next turn, maybe you'll have initiative and you'll be going first in each phase after that. So like I say, it means that you can't deploy and then start thinking with the tape measure, you know, on turn two, I'm going to be here. And because it might not work like that, you know, your opponent might get the opportunity to go first.
Mm. So how is that decided?
So you're rolling for initiative, and this is maybe something I've not got verbatim, but the more as the turn progresses, you need to roll above the turn number or below the turn number. It's something clever like that, where it becomes either more or less likely that initiative will pass to the other player as the game progresses. Again, there's a clever wee mechanic there that I'm not doing justice, but yeah, the point is the initiative could be quite fluid, and it makes it more unpredictable.
Yeah, that's cool, man. That's interesting. That's really good. And so how is charging decided? No, before we go to charging, let's talk about magic. So magic is something that sets like high fantasy games apart from low fantasy games or like historicals, right? So you mentioned A Song of Blades and Heroes, which I don't believe has magic, correct me if I'm wrong. So how does magic work in the game, and is that a really fun part of it? Do you really enjoy that part?
Yeah, so I've read into the magic. I've not actually used it on the table yet, although we're planning to bring that in our next game. But magic basically works like you have at least one of your units where you would mark them as a wizard. So that's a keyword that you add. And you have things called Mercury tokens. So that determines how powerful your spell's going to be. So I think there's 8 different magic types in the book. So you're basically, when you're building your army, you're saying, okay, this unit here has my wizard, or this character is my wizard. So you pick what kind of wizard they are, and that tells you the three spells that they can cast. So there's like a low level spell, a middling spell, and then a very powerful spell. And the difference between this and other games in the genre is that your magic will always work. It's not like you try and do a spell and it fails, or you do a spell and the opponent dispels it. Like, you will always get your spell off. Wizards will cast magic and they always work. The caveat is that it's up to you how many Mercury tokens you're going to spend. So if you spend 2, you're going to do your, your kind of weak spell. But the more you spend, the better that spell is going to be. But obviously that comes at a cost. So,
right.
What's got your attention right now in the hobby? What are you painting, playing, or planning for this month? head on over to bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail to submit a clip for our monthly hobby update episode. That link again is bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail. And now back to the show.
That's cool. But yeah, because I mean, we talked about this before, think with certain games where you kind of think that, oh, this is a big bad guy, he's going to get the stuff done, you know, and you get all your dice out and you roll your dice and either misses or backfires, or then, oh no, I've got a scroll of dispelling, and then you just like dispel it, and it's like, oh, so that 5 minutes where I was getting all excited about my spell, yeah, it doesn't really matter. It kind of leaves a little bit of a sour taste in people's mouths sometimes. So you mentioned it kind of always goes off, but you've got a finite amount of tokens. How are those tokens decided? Is it like the skill of the wizard, the amount of points that you put into the wizard, and is there an opportunity to get them back, or is it literally a case of once they're gone, they're gone?
So I think you start with about four and you pick them up at the start of each new turn, and I think you also get some when units die. I think that's a kind of catch-up mechanic. So I think there's a few different opportunities to collect them, save them up, use them when need be. But yeah, you always have the opportunity to get more as well. So
that's cool, man. And so charging, because like magic, that sets it apart from other games, you know, that maybe don't include magic at all. But charging is a key feature of mass battle games, right? So how does the declaration of a charge happen? How does the charge occur? And, you know, is there possibilities to actually not charge because you don't quite get far enough, or like what's the deal with charging?
Yeah, I don't know if do you want me to go into shooting first, because that's actually the next phase.
Yeah.
So after magic comes shooting, so any ranged weapon, any ranged units, from archers to, you know, you get war machines as well, so cannons and that, so they'll all fire. What I really like about Hobgoblin is that, again, I don't want to talk Hobgoblin up by talking other games down, but some other games will have what they call the alpha strike, won't they? So you could you could basically obliterate the opposition in the shooting phase or whatever, just whenever you're able to, you know, get the first shot. And this is very limited in Hobgoblin because it's rare that you'll be able to actually kill anyone with your ranged troops. So usually, when you're firing at a unit, you could only reduce them to half strength. Like, you can't actually kill them. There are a few exceptions. You know, there are certain unit types that you can take out through ranged combat, but it's rare. So, again, it's like, I like the way that that's, you use that as a tool to maybe soften the opponent up a bit, but you're not finishing the game. You know, you're not living or dying based on the shooting phase. So yeah, you'll both do your shooting. And again, a great part of Hobgoblin as well is that when, I guess we'll talk about this in combat, but you're not removing units straight away when they're quote unquote killed. But I guess, yeah, better talking about that in the combat phase. You do your shooting first. You try and soften up the opposition. You're probably not going to kill anyone. But yeah, like you're saying, then you're getting into movement. You know, you're going to have the opportunity to get maybe not straight into combat, but certainly almost the way there. And there's no actual charge. I mean, there are some keywords that will give you a bit of a buff. You know, certain units, for example, like heavy cavalry, when they move into combat with somebody, they're getting a little bonus there based on the momentum. You know, if they've charged more than, I think it's 6 inches, they're going to get a wee bonus there. But yeah, it's not like an official charge declaration or that. You're just literally moving into combat with another unit.
Okay, so that's just in a movement phase, you'll just move within an inch, right? Or you move into base contact, and if you just move into base combat, that's technically a charge.
Yeah, it's base contact, yeah. And obviously, you know, you could move into the front, or you could move into the sides or the rear and get other bonuses that way as well. So, which I know is fairly standard in this style of game.
What are your options for movement in the movement phase? Is it, can you move like every direction without any negative modifier? Is it as easy to move backwards as forwards? You know, what's the deal with movement?
Yeah, I think it's fairly typical with, you know, like wheeling and stuff like that, where you're holding one front corner in place, and you could spin your unit round. You could reform your troops and everything like that. So it's pretty flexible with how you could move around. There are certain situations where your unit will temporarily be affected by a keyword, what's known as the distracted keyword. And all that means is you can't end up in combat with a unit that you weren't in combat with already. It's to prevent things like you taking a unit and literally reversing them into combat, which would just not be thematic at all. So that's just in place to avoid any silliness on that front. But generally it is pretty flexible with the movement as well. It's not, you know, again, I don't want to keep going on about other games, which I've no real experience of, but I get the feeling that, you know, some rule sets will almost treat a unit of troops as if it's like some sort of battleship where it has to, you know, spin around in this massive, really slow, laborious arc. And I don't feel that limited with Hobgoblin. So
that's cool. Is there a place for like heroes and generals and like special characters, or is it just units that rule the roost?
Yeah, I mean, it's totally up to you what you want to put on the table. But yeah, certainly two of your units at least, one of them's going to be, I think it's your leader, that's a keyword. So whatever unit you choose to have as your leader, or whatever character you want to declare your leader, is going to get certain little buffs, and your battle standard as well, which could be the same unit or it could be another unit. So it's totally dependent on your miniatures collection. But yeah, you could have a very heroic army. I mean, it's really, because it's all multi-based, like a unit is just the entity, it doesn't really matter what's on there individually. So you could do anything you want from a miniature point of view.
Cool. So let's say that I've moved my, you know, swordsman, elite swordsman unit into your kind of just light infantry. Like, how, and I initiated that movement, how does the combat then occur?
Yeah, so most combats will be a case of rolling 10 dice. So there are opportunities. Some units with certain keywords, you'll roll maybe up to 13 dice. But yeah, you've got a nice table in the book, which basically you would look at that. So, you know, my heavy infantry, they move into combat with your light infantry. I just look at that chart and I know I need to roll fours or up. So I'll roll my 10 dice and basically all the fours are up are hits, if that makes sense. So it's very simple. Yeah. So instead of there being roll to hit, roll to wound, roll to save, that's all accounted for in this one roll. And it's basically, you know, that number of hits that you roll, that becomes what's called doom tokens, and that goes on to your opponent.
So what happens with those tokens over time? Like, as I accumulate them, so I don't get any save at all. And when those tokens accumulate, what then happens?
Yeah, so doom represents wounds and morale, really. It's just an all-encompassing term for that. So, you know, whether you're literally killing them or you're just making them very unhappy, they're collecting doom as they, you know, as they lose combats. So generally it'll be, I think it's marked against the unit's courage, which will generally be 10. So you've got a courage of 10, and if I could get you up to 10 doom, that's basically me going to eliminate you. There are some little loopholes here where I talked about how one of your units would have maybe a command keyword or a battle standard keyword. If you're within 8 inches of that unit, that could temporarily increase your courage by one or two. So you might have the opportunity to stay on the table a little bit longer than you perhaps would have if you were, you know, isolated. So yeah, you're picking up doom tokens, and there's actually a doom phase as well. So like if a unit, I think it's within 8 inches of you, if they're eliminated, you'll get an extra doom token, and there could be a cascade effect. And often this does happen as well. It's like panic spreading down the ranks, you know. Bob and the lads have just been killed, so like I get one more doom, but that takes me over the limit of 10, and then so I've broken, and then I'm passing that on to somebody else. So that's what gets quite fun about it. Once the killing starts, is, you know, the panic spread, and it just gives it an extra little dimension at the end of the turn.
That seems to be where the speed kind of comes in. You know, you mentioned like rolling 10 dice and looking for four ups, you know, so it sounds like that combat is quite short and sharp as opposed to something that's long and drawn out, would you say?
Yeah, and as much as I love, we talked about it already, but Song of Blades and Heroes, really good game. One of the things that kind of lets that down is that combat could just become a bit of a pushing contest at certain points. Like, yeah, you know, I'm hitting you, but I'm not really doing any damage. You're hitting me, and we're just kind of on the table. Like, you've got these two characters together and nothing's really happening. I feel like in Hobgoblin, like, you'll get a unit into combat with me, and you know, the chances are you'll do a decent amount of damage no matter what the matchup is. And then, you know, I'm mm-hmm. going to reply to that as well and do a bit of damage. So it's, once units get into combat, their days are numbered, you know, no matter how good they are. It's usually just a case of who could take who out first. But one of the areas the game shines as well is that if I eliminate your unit, you know, if I take one of your units to, like, say 13 or 14 Doom tokens, like, they're going to be removed, they're going to be killed. You're not going to have to remove them without having the right to reply in combat. So if I've went first in the combat, okay, you know, I've hit you, you're still going to get to hit me back before your unit gets removed at the end of the turn. And I really like that.
That's good. At least you can reply. Yeah, that's good. Because, yeah, it's sometimes if people are very, very strategic or just lucky with certain movements at certain things, yeah, you can kind of get wiped out before you go. So, yeah, that's cool, man. I like that. So is there a way to mitigate Doom? You mentioned there that there's a Doom phase. So is there a way to kind of, like, to rally or to kind of, you know, disengage from contact and kind of, you know, calm down a little bit? Or is it just no way, you just got to plow, it's like push forward, just got to get in, smash them about and hopefully win?
Yeah, so there's a couple of wee things. Like, there's a certain keyword that you could add to your unit, which means, like, if they kill a unit, I think they could reduce a certain amount of Doom tokens. I don't know if it's a D6 amount of Doom tokens. Mm-hmm. So certain keywords are going to reduce your Doom. There are also, you've got a deck of cards which you have the option to buy alongside the book and use this deck as well. It's called the Fortune deck. So it's a little mm-hmm. deck of cards. You'll have maybe three or four of them, and you could play them at certain times. You know, you'll know your hand, your opponent won't. But certain things will happen on the table that enables you at any point just to play this card, and it'll kick something into effect. But yeah, I think you could literally discard one of these cards to remove a Doom token from a unit, or you could discard one of these cards to get a reroll. So again, it just mm-hmm. gives you a bit of options. If there's one particular unit that you think victory is integral to keeping this unit on the table, then you're going to have a couple of options to, you know, to make some sacrifices elsewhere to try and keep them on the table a wee bit longer.
That's cool, man. Is there anything more about, like, rule stuff or general bits and bobs that you feel we need to talk about before we move on?
No, I mean, that is really it. Like, it's a big old book with a lot of stuff in it, but that is the general gist of it. Like, it's a very, I know you hate this term, Dan, because it gets so overused, but what's it, easy to pick up, hard to master?
I know
you go on about that, but I would put this game in this category, because even a dafty like me managed to learn it, and we're at the stage now, me and Calum, where we've played it a few times that we are now playing the armies, we're now playing the tactics, we're not in the rule book all the time, and I like getting to that stage with a game. It's past the dating stage now. We're sitting on the sofa watching Netflix together. So
nice. That's cool. It sounds good. I think there's a few things that draw me to it. One is, like, the kind of open nature, not too restrictive. And the second thing is that time. You mentioned the time, like an hour and a half game. You know, sometimes there's a lot of prevaricating around, you know, a lot of messing around before the game even begins. But it seems to be, it gets you straight into the action quite quickly, which definitely sets it apart. And so you mentioned that you've kind of just played things that occur to you as being fun, right? You know, in terms of scenarios and things. So what have been your best game experiences? So if you think about the games that you've played, what have made those games exciting and interesting and make you want to play more of it?
So when we did the matchup between the evil forces versus the you know, the much smaller good guys army, this was really unbalanced, because you had, you know, the bad guys were like twice the size of the good guys, and there was a couple of little tips in the book for the way you could handle a game like that to make sure it's not just a complete massacre. So one of the things you do is to increase the courage of the small army. So that means that instead of 10 doom tokens, you could now accommodate 15, or you could even put it up to 20 if it was a really unbalanced match off. So that just means that, you know, you've got more wounds or whatever. You could call doom wounds if you want. So there's that. And you can also add what's called the fearless keyword to your units as well. So that means that they're immune to this spread and panic that we talked about. So, you know, Once one unit does get eliminated, that's not going to set off a cascade right down your line. So again, if you're doing the classic, you know, I've got these five units of dwarf heroes against like this 25 unit horde, it just means that it's a little bit more fun. You're not just going to end up losing the game because like one unit broke and that caused everyone to panic. And doing these big unbalanced scenarios, you still do want to have those little things in place. That just means it's not, you know, a complete washout. So
yeah. So is there anything else about the game that you want to bring up that kind of makes you want to bang the drum about it?
No, I think that's it. What I would say, I'm not one of these folks that, you know, tells people they should buy something, but I would say, like, if you do have armies in your collection, you know, they don't even have to be fantasy armies, but even if you've got like a historical armies or that, I would definitely consider picking it up and giving it a go. You don't even have to buy the book. You could buy the PDF, which I think is a wee bit cheaper. And yeah, it's just a great game. Thoroughly recommend trying it out. And it does give me that feeling of playing, you know, the games, what I imagined the games of Warhammer were like when I was reading White Dwarf as a kid. It just gives you that kind of, that vibe. So,
it seems to be very focused, right? It seems to be, it's very focused. There's not a lot of clutter. There's not a lot of messing. It seems to be like straight to it, simple, bang, bang, done, right?
Yeah, exactly. And again, I know there's a slight pushback against the idea that modern games should be very fast and efficient, but you know, I never feel rushed with the game. I don't feel like we're battering through it just to get it done. That's definitely not the case. I feel like we enjoy the games, but also, you know, we are done in a couple of hours. So almost feel like that lets you relax, because you know, if I thought, well, a game might take 6 hours, maybe I would be clock watching, because I'd want to be going faster because I don't have 6 hours. So I don't know, there's a paradox there where it's a super fast game, but in a way that gives you a lot of room to breathe, where you are taking your time throughout turns and, you know, you're stopping for a wee chat. You know, we've even stopped for a cup of tea at half time and that, and just, you know, sit down, have a wee look over the table, have a wee look at how things are going. So I think in a way that makes a game more relaxing when you know that it's not going to last.
It's just different. It's just a tool in a toolbox, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like sometimes you do really want a really deep, very huge depth, thinking about all these different things, cast a spell, dispel the spell, you know, attack, you know, defend, you know, armor save. And other times it's just do something different. It's neither better nor worse. It's just a different experience, right? That's important to note.
Yeah, I mean, that's the beauty of the hobby. There's something for everyone, isn't there? There's a game that will cater to absolutely any taste. If you want the big 3-day battle, and I know a lot of guys do, and that's brilliant. Like, the game's there for you. If you want to play a game like this, it's here. Like, you always find what fits best with your tastes and your time limits.
I do really like how you can just do whatever you want. So, like, whatever force you might have anyway, or if you've always wanted a certain force, you can use that. I do really like that. I think that's really cool. So if I picked up a while ago something that I've wanted for ages but never got around to, and it just came up on a trade, I traded something out for it and got like a dwarf army, but I've not played any games with it yet. So I've got this dwarf army, but knowing that I've got Mayhem that I could play, knowing that I've got Kings of War that I could play, and then I could potentially pick this up, and now I've got three games that I could use the same force with. It's a lot of value. It's good. I like that. Even if it just remains a prospect and not something I actually do, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've mentioned a game once on your podcast, Song, Ice and Fire. So, I mean, your armies for that, they would fit into any of the games that you mentioned there, including Hobgoblin.
Yeah, yeah. And I bought Baron's War recently. Yeah. I came up in secondhand as well. Because the same thing, I can use minis that I've already got in Baron's War. So it's always worth keeping an eye open for games that you could potentially play, but you don't need to buy any extra models for. It kind of gives a whole bunch of extra mileage to things that you already have, which is pretty thrifty. It's always pretty good to be thrifty, right?
Yeah, I mean, I've always, since coming back into the hobby, I've built my miniature collection around that ethos, as I'm sure most people do. You know, everything I buy, I'm thinking about not just what game I'm going to use them for, but what's the three, maybe four games that they could be used for. Yeah. So I just love that about the hobby, that miniature agnostic approach.
Yeah, that's cool, man. Awesome. Well, I can't think of any more questions I'd like to ask you. I think you've done a really good job kind of laying it out for us, and I think people can go and find out more if they so desire. What about painting? You mentioned that you're using 15 mil. So like, where did you get them from, and how was the painting up for those?
Yeah, it was a totally new scale for me. Like I say, I find it, I've referred to it as the Goldilocks scale before. I don't think I coined that phrase by any means, but it's definitely apt. 28 mil is brilliant, but to build big blocks of troops at 28, obviously there's a room cost there. So I like the way 15 mil kind of made it just a bit more compact, but as much as a scale like 6 mil is brilliant for so many reasons, you're kind of losing the individuality of each troop on your yeah. base. So 15 mil, it was still like painting a, you know, just a very small 28 mil model, for lack of a better explanation there. But you certainly get through them a bit quicker. They don't need as much detail, but there are certain ones, you know, character models and that I did try and spend a wee bit more time on. But a very fun scale to paint, and very satisfying once I've seen, you know, 8 or 9 units laid out together as well. A great aesthetic, I think.
That's cool. So what are your next steps with the game? Is it just literally a case of just building up the experience of playing and just enjoying the kind of getting into the deeper realms of the game? Or like, you started moving on to terrain? Have you started moving on to scenario design? Because I know that you're interested in rules writing and stuff like that yourself. So like, how is your kind of experience going to develop over the next year?
Yeah, so I just bought some characters to be wizards in the three armies. So I got them all from Ral Partha, which is actually where I got a lot of the miniatures for my armies. Pendraken's another good place that I've found for getting models at this scale. But Ral Partha's brilliant, as I'm sure many people are already familiar with. So yeah, I've put those wizards together. I just need to paint them up. And then that means that we could move on to having a magic phase and you know, using magic in the games. Getting more into the fortune deck as well, I think will be a next step for us. And yeah, just keeping it narrative as well. The last game we played was very much just a pitched battle, which was a lot of fun. But doing scenarios and storytelling, hopefully, you know, linked stories as well, sort of campaign level stuff, I think that's really where any game shines. So just looking forward to doing more of that. And now that the rules make perfect sense to us, like I say, we are just playing the game rather than the, you know, nosing through a book. So
awesome, mate. Well, thanks a lot for your time, mate. It's always good to talk. It's been too long between our last conversation and this one. So hopefully we can find another reason to talk again soon.
Yeah, I hope so, Dan. Thank you for collaborating on this. You did all the legwork. I just tried to pretend I knew what I was talking about. Hopefully I managed it.
It's always a pleasure, mate.
Cheers, Dan. Thanks very much for listening to this episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. If you enjoy the show, then please do share it with someone else you think might enjoy it too. And be sure to check out our Discord community of like-minded hobbyists, which you could find at bedroombattlefields.com/Discord. It'd be great to see you in there.